This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll hear Terry's interview with Barbara Streisand. But first, a conversation and performance with guitarist and singer John Pizzarelli. He made his first recording in 1980 with his father, the great rhythm guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli. Today we'll hear about some of John's career highlights from the last 30-plus years, like touring as the opening act for Frank Sinatra and recording with Paul McCartney. And Pizzarelli will perform some holiday songs for us, accompanied by his brother, Martin Pizzarelli, on bass. John Pizzarelli has a new memoir called World on a String and a new album called Double Exposure.
John Pizzarelli, Martin Pizzarelli, welcome back to Fresh Air. You're going to perform my favorite Christmas song, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. But before you do, John, you tell a good story about this song in your new memoir, World on a String. And it's about performing it with James Taylor. So before you do the song, tell us a story.
Well, we had just recorded a song called Mean Old Man for his October Road record. And it went so fast in the studio that we were just all staring at each other, listening to playback, and we thought that was it. And I sort of leaned over to James Taylor. I really wasn't supposed to speak. And I said, hey, James, you got any more originals like that? And he sort of looked over at Russ Titelman, the producer, and he said, well, we could do that other song. And the song was Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. I guess they wanted a bonus cut. He said, I want to do the verse, but I can't figure the verse out. And I looked at the music, and it just had chords, you know. Christmas present is far away, Christmas best is past. It was just sort of very simple. And I remember advice from my father, who always says, look in the bass line, the treble clef, the bass clef, because there might be different notes in there that'll lead you in the right direction. And so I looked down at the bottom, and I saw it just wasn't an A chord. It was actually an A with C sharp in the bass. Christmas, da 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 da. And I put it all together, and I was able to play it with him, and we did some beautiful takes of that. And it was my father's advice that saved me on that spur-of-the-moment little moment there in the studio.
So do me a favor, just like do a couple of lines the way it was written with the more bland chord.
Sure.
And then do a couple of lines the way you did it after reading the bass clef.
Sure, I think it would probably be like this. It was probably like A and E, just Christmas present is far away, Christmas past is past. That would be the beginning, but instead it was Christmas future is far away, Christmas past is past. And it really was beautiful. When we put it all together, it was really lovely.
Nice. Well, now do the song for real for us. And this is John Pizzarelli on guitar and vocal and Martin Pizzarelli on bass.
Christmas future is far away. Christmas past is past. Christmas present is here today, bringing joys that will last. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. The Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Here we are as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years, we all will be together, if the fates allow. Hang Being a shining star upon the highest bough. And have yourself a merry little Christmas now.
Nice. That's John Pizzarelli singing in on vocals with Martin Pizzarelli on bass. So, Martin, what do you think of the story that John told about reading the bass line in that song and then really understanding what the chords would be, since you are a bass player and the bass clef is kind of where you live?
It makes perfect sense, and I'm sure that's my dad always has told us to look at the bass note. It's the most important part of the chord, especially on the left hand of the piano.
It's all really, the ear training comes from all that, too. If you didn't know, if you were on a bandstand playing rhythm guitar, I would always turn to bass players who were working with me, like Milt Hinton or Bob Haggard or Slam Stewart, and I'd say, I need your help, and they'd say, no problem. They just play. When you hear the bass note, you can always hear the harmony first. The bass note was always the most important part of hearing the harmonies.
So you both played in a rock band together.
Several, yes.
Several. in high school, I take it?
We played a lot in high school together. Actually, he joined the band. There was Omega, which is the last word in rock and roll. He was in a band we had called Sanpaku. We had As Is. We eventually, into our late 20s, my late 20s anyway, we had a band called Johnny Pick and His Scabs, which was, it started because we replaced a band at our local club, and so we were calling ourselves the Scabs because we were replacing our friend's group. But then we had a play on words, and we would change the name on weekly basis. Johnny Ride and the Waves. Johnny Shuck and the Clams was another one, right? So, but the Scabs were infamous in downtown Manhattan for a 6-month period of time on Saturday nights.
Okay. So, you've been really lucky. I mean, you've had a nice career playing American popular song, and you got to do the thing that everybody who plays American song, American popular song, would have wanted to do, which is open for Sinatra on a world tour. And this was in 1993. It was 5 years before Sinatra died. What are some of the places you got to perform with him around the world?
We played five or six cities in Germany: Dortmund, Berlin, Hamburg, Cologne. I mean, the thing about all the dates in Germany was all the dates were, they started at 5,000 and worked their way up. We were 20,000 people in Hamburg, and we had 85,000 to 10,000 people in Cologne. So, and then we came back to the States and we played Chastain Park in Atlanta for 7,500 people. We played the Garden State Arts Center in New Jersey, which was another 5,000, 7,500 people. We played the Sands in Atlantic City for a week. It was playing for huge amounts of Sinatra lovers. You know, you played in Chastain Park, and while you're doing your beginning set, there are people with their back to you eating pesto and, having their pasta and everything going. He'll be done soon, and Sinatra
No, exactly.
So.
No, what's it like to perform for, 40,000 people who came to hear someone else? came to hear Sinatra, and they don't necessarily know who you are. They don't necessarily care who you are.
It's true. And we had a very quick 20-minute set that was sort of and it was fun. It was a good set. It went straight ahead, and it was just sort of let everybody settle in to let them know. And you sort of realized they were going to settle down, and, they knew that, about 25 minutes now. So some people listened. The funny thing was, in Atlantic City, after the gigs, and you'd be hanging around the hotel, and people thought that you really, you were hanging out with Frank. So they would come up to you and say, I got this song about Hoboken. You got to give it to Frank. And I was like, you have to understand, I'm lucky if I see Frank Sinatra in the wings before the show.
How much did see or talk to him?
I spoke to him once before the show in Berlin. It was a rather funny meeting because Hank Cattaneo, who ran everything, felt it was the right time to go say hello to Frank. And when he was going to introduce me, he got nervous, which it messed the whole thing up. And he sort of coughed out the words opening act to Frank Sinatra. And I swung around and shook his hand and said, it's nice to meet you. And I was about to walk away, and Frank Sinatra said, eat something, you look bad. And that was pretty much all I got out of Frank Sinatra on the whole tour.
So what kind of shape was he in then?
He was... you know, he was in Frail. He was frail. I mean, Martin and I saw him in 86 at the Brendan Byrne Arena, and we felt like he was singing to us. It was such a magical concert. They have released that concert now on a record, Live at the Meadowlands, and it's as good as I thought it was. But these concerts were, you know, he was just frail. He was walking around, and he was singing okay, but it wasn't the powerful persona that we were used to seeing. But one day in Chastain Park at the rehearsal, he came out and he sang three numbers. He was challenged by Frank Jr., who put his fist up into his father's face and said, "You've got to fight it." And Sinatra looked at him like, "Oh, okay, what do you got?" And so he sang "The House I Live In," "Luck Be a Lady Tonight," and "Come Rain or Come Shine." And we were sitting way up in the seats. We were the only people out, 7,000 empty seats except for three of us eating a pizza. And we were crying because it was so beautiful. He sang so impeccably without any teleprompters or anything. He just was like, "Okay, you're going to challenge me? I can still do this." And he did those three songs, put his mic down. It was so hot outside. And he said, "Throw another log on the air conditioner. I'm out of here."
So can I ask you to do a shout out to Frank Sinatra and play a few bars of a song that he did when you were on tour with him, a song that you love?
Hold on a string.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3. I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song I can sing, I can make the rain go anytime I move my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love.
Thank you. And coincidentally, World on a String just happens
right.
to be the title of John Pizzarelli's new memoir, which is an amazing coincidence. That was
very
nice.
We're all about promotion here in the John Pizzarelli duo today.
John, in your memoir, you write a little bit about getting to know Rosemary Clooney, and you sang duets with her. You recorded and performed with her. How did you get to know her? How did you first start to perform with her?
Rosemary played at the Rainbow and Stars. She was a constant figure around town, around New York City, at least once a year with 4-week engagements. Wherever the current room was. And when I first became aware of her being close to where I was, she was at the Rainbow and Stars. I was working the dance room. The Rainbow Room itself, and she was in this Rainbow, it's the cabaret room. And so I'd see the posters and things. And my father said, "I'm going to be doing February with her." And I had just had All of Me come out, my first record on RCA. I think that was the first time I was on Fresh Air, as a matter of fact. Years and years and years
ago.
Yes. And so my father said, "I can't do all the dates. You want a sub for me?" And I said, "Oh, I'd love to play with Rosemary Clooney. That would be great." And so my manager at the time was, "You shouldn't be a sideman. You know, I don't know why you're doing these things." I said, "It's Rosemary Clooney." I said, "So this is the way we're going to do this." And my father was great. You know, he'd say, "Come over and I'll go over my whole part with you." So he'd say, "Here's, you're going to play rhythm on this thing, you know." And he said, "On this one, it was Spring Is Here." He showed me that I had to play like... And just follow, you know, those are the chords, just follow Rosemary as she's singing. I said, "Okay." And at the end, he had some ending that was like, "The spring is here, they're here." And I'd play that. So the first night I played that, but the second night I had my own ending, and Joe Cocuzzo, the drummer, went, "Oh, that's good. That was good." So I was getting more and more comfortable. Alan Sverdoff, her manager, always wanted to have me play with her. He was like, he liked me, have me around, because I guess she was comfortable with me, and I got to do more of the gigs later on than my father did. And we, you know, it wasn't just about playing gigs. I'd make records. We'd go out to dinner. And she was just, she was the other Sinatra to me. And she sang impeccably all the way till the end. She was really amazing.
I'm such a big fan of hers, and got to interview her on stage once as she performed songs. So it was a wonderful experience. You say in your memoir that one of the things you learn from her is that no matter how you're feeling, you can put that aside and give a good performance. And how was she feeling when you knew her? I mean,
there were moments of her. Even Stephen Holden would talk about her size. You know, she was a large woman, and so that hindered. If the room wasn't, you know, they made the rooms pretty cold at Feinstein's. Like, it's like being on Letterman. It was cold, so she, you know, wouldn't, because that helped her breathe better, and it kept her body temperature good, so she could have, you know, a better experience. And there was one concert in Mackinac Island at the Grand Hotel where she kept singing. It was a big room, and it was hot in there. It looked like the barn from White Christmas, which she actually said on the stage. But she'd turn around and say, I don't know if I can, we're going to have to cut a number, John. She'd say to John Otto, her piano player. And I was right there, and I was scared. And the more people applauded, she'd just turn around and keep singing. And the crowd would always inform her. If they were really going crazy, she could get by bad breathing and all the things. And on any given day, there was always something magical that she could do, no matter how she was feeling.
Can I ask you to do a song that relates to knowing and working with Rosemary Clooney?
Sure. You know, the last gig we did with her was at Foxwoods. As a matter of fact, it was her Christmas show. It was funny because I didn't realize it was the Christmas show, and I had only so many charts for the band. They had a big band, and Alan Sverdoff, her manager, wanted us to play a couple songs up front, like 25 minutes. Then Rosie would do the show that she had done all over the place, this Christmas show. And then I think I did a number with her at the end, and then I went off and she sang Count Your Blessings at the very end. The funny thing is I was doing Route 66, and he said, is that the route Santa Claus takes? Is that a Christmas song? He kept saying me backstage. But it's the only chart I had. But I remember after she had me come out and take a bow, and I went backstage and I stood in the wings, and she was just sitting in a chair in front of this, you know, big Christmas setting with a band behind her, and just with John Otto sang Count Your Blessings. That's the last song I ever heard her sing. And I remember going, well, I just couldn't. I was so touched by it. It was such a beautiful moment. So I'll play that for you in honor of Rosemary.
Thank you.
When I'm worried and I can't sleep, I count my blessings instead of sheep. I fall asleep counting my blessings. And when my bankroll is getting small, I think of when I had none at all. And I fall asleep counting my blessings. I think about a nursery and I picture curly heads. And one by one I count them as they slumber in their beds. If you are worried and you can't sleep, just count your blessings instead of sheep. You'll fall asleep counting your blessings.
Nice. And that song was actually in the 1954 movie White Christmas, which Rosemary Clooney and Bing Crosby starred in.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a fan of the film?
Oh, I watch it now every Christmas. It's hard to talk about because I love watching her in the movie. So I'll watch it three or four times. You know, I just love it. I love seeing her, and it's just a special thing for me.
Well, my guest is John Pizzarelli, who's a singer and guitarist and now author of the new book, memoir, World on a String, and he has a new record called Double Exposure. And his brother Martin Pizzarelli is also with us playing bass today, and they perform together around the world. John, you recently worked with Paul McCartney, and for anyone who knows Paul McCartney's latest album, Kisses on the Bottom, which is an album of songs, mostly songs of his father's generation, including some well-known and lesser-known standards, you're on that record.
And I am.
Yeah, and I remember back in the 90s or early 2000s when you had a Beatles album that you did, you know, an album of Beatles songs.
Yes, I did a record called John Pizzarelli Meets the Beatles. I think it was 1996 or 97 that it came out. And I always joke about it because on Amazon, you know, there's always reviews. It's the one record of mine, I have 21 vocal records, that has the most reviews and the most disparate reviews. Some, I'd say, John Pizzarelli is the greatest interpreter of these songs. And then there's one where the subject matter says Abbey Roadkill. and so I have all these crazy... there must be 50 of them. And I, you know, and then there's also, you know, a person from New York writes, John Pizzarelli is a genius. And those are written by me to try and knock off the Abbey Roadkill reviews. But when I met Paul McCartney at the session, he walked in and he said hello to Diana Krall and then her bass player and then her drummer. And then they came over to me and they said, this is Paul McCartney. And I said, it's nice to meet you. And he went, you made a Beatles CD. And I went, oh, boy, here it comes. And he said to me, it's very good. And I was like, oh, I said, could you write that on Amazon, please? It's really helped me out. But he was really a real fine musician. He is a real fine musician. And that record was so great because he let the jazz musicians do what they do best, and he didn't edit them. And if he liked something, he said, do that. If he didn't, he'd say, oh, let's try something else. So we were able to do a lot of takes and spend a lot of time and really be relaxed. And Diana Krall ran a great ship with Tommy LaPuma, the producer, and Paul was just tremendous. And the material was great. There were some great songs on that record.
So did you pick up anything from him, or do you think he picked up anything from you?
He kept saying that the experience was a lot like the early Beatle days because he'd say, you know, we first came into the studio, only John and I knew the songs, you know, so we had to teach them to George and Ringo and George Martin. And then, you know, we could only do three in a session and then we had to move on. So the one story that he told was, you know, he said, you know, that song, And I Love Her. And we'd always go like, yeah, I think we know that. and he said, you know, we just taught George and Ringo and everybody the song and we just went, you know, go. And we counted it off and George went and played that lick. And he says, we didn't tell him to play that lick, but can you imagine the song without it? No, George just did it. And he goes, this is what we were doing. We were, when we were learning the songs, see, we were just sort of discovering what worked. And he was very, it was just made for a real great experience. The thing that I learned is that it's great to be Paul McCartney because you can spend a lot of time in the studio.
right. They'll cut you some slack if you're Paul McCartney.
Yeah, so, well, it's always he's always just says, you know, we already have the take we want. Let's do another take just to see what happens. You know, it was always fun and it made for a very relaxed experience.
You've written some songs yourself. And one of them is a Christmas song, so I thought I should ask you to do that. And it's called Santa Claus is Near. So tell us about the song and why you wrote it.
Well, I had what I always like to call the ill-fated John Pizzarelli Christmas CD, which was called Let's Share Christmas. Nobody wanted to share. I think it's still available just on one of the, you know, you can send away for it or something. You can get it somewhere. And I just felt we needed a Santa Claus song, and I didn't want to do Santa Claus is Coming to Town, and you always want to put an original song on a record that's going to sell in the tens. So I came up with this little song called Santa Claus is Near. So I would love to regale you with that now. One, two, three. That special time is coming. The kids are on their best. The cold at times is numbing from the east coast to the west. Snowflakes keep on falling as it's jingle bells I hear. Well, let's all be good like we know we should, for Santa Claus is near. Here comes Santa, riding in his sleigh. Here comes Santa, my roof is his runway. Special time is coming, the kids are on their best. Oh, the cold at times is numbing from the east coast to the west. Snowflakes keep on falling as its jingle bells I hear. Well, let's all be good like we know we should, for Santa Claus is here. Santa Claus is here. Santa Claus is here. Thank you.
No, it's a nice song. That's catchy.
It actually isn't bad. I actually like it. And there's been cover versions I keep discovering now and then, and I'm awfully proud that people are discovering Santa Claus is near. They liked it at the Boston Pops. We did it at the Boston Pops for their TV show because they could, when you say Santa Claus is near, and at the end, Santa Claus is here, and they brought out Santa Claus, and they were like, well, this is going to work for us. But they only used it the one year. They were being nice to me.
I guess that didn't help sales of your album, though.
No, it's still, I think the release date, too, was December 26th.
There's time for one more song. So why don't I ask you to do something seasonal? What would you like to do?
I'm very fond of What Are You Doing New Year's Eve?
And that's a Frank Lesser song. It's a great song.
Yeah.
Why are you so fond of it?
I actually heard Dave Frischberg sing it many years ago on a record in the midst of a Frank Lesser medley on one of his records from the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco. I always had that record because he did Zoot Walked In on it too, one of his songs. And I thought this, and it was just beautiful. So, basically I'm a big fan of Frischberg's, and it's also on the ill-fated John Pizzarelli Christmas CD. So I'd love to play it for you right now.
Okay.
Three, four. Maybe it's much too early in the game. Ah, but I thought I'd ask you just the same. What are you doing New Year's? New Year's Eve. Wonder whose arms will hold you good and tight when it's exactly 12 o'clock that night, welcoming in the new year, New Year's Eve. Maybe I'm crazy to suppose I'd ever be the one you chose out of the thousand invitations you'll receive. Ah, but in case I stand one little chance, here comes that jackpot question in advance. What are you doing New Year's? New Year's Eve.
John and Martin Pizzarelli performing the Frank Lesser song, What Are You Doing New Year's Eve? John Pizzarelli has written a new memoir called World on a String. Coming up, Barbara Streisand. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Barbara Streisand has had a long career in movies, music, and on Broadway, and she talked about it with Terry earlier this week. We're going to hear that conversation now. Let's start with a clip from the new comedy film The Guilt Trip, starring Streisand and Seth Rogen. Rogen plays a 30-something scientist who's invented a new eco-friendly cleanser he's trying to convince one of the major chain stores to stock. He plans to rent a car in New Jersey and drive across the country, making stops along the way to plug his product. Just before hitting the road, Rogen's character decides to invite his mother, played by Barbara Streisand, to accompany him. He has an ulterior motive that he doesn't reveal to her.
Do you want to come on my trip with me, Mom? You want to drive cross country with me?
Yeah. No, it's, you know, we won't be gone long. It's only 8 days in a car together.
Wait a minute. I want to make sure that I'm hearing this correctly. You want to spend a week in a car with your mother?
More than anything in the world.
Don't you think I might get on your nerves a little bit?
No, it was just a thought, and if you don't want to do it, then fine. I don't want to push you in.
What? Am I so awful that you can't spend a little time in a car with me?
I'm inviting you. Do you want to come with? Do you want to drive across the country with me?
Well, I'd have to reroute my mail.
You have 5 seconds to tell me whether you want to go or not.
I can't wait. What, are you kidding me? Honey, that is so exciting.
Great.
Yeah,
I am.
Talk to
okay.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I can't believe it. I have to touch my roots, though, before I go. What are we going to pack? You got to fill me in on all the weather conditions in all the states that we're going to go through.
Barbara Streisand, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thank you.
Did you think of anybody or any people in particular when you were creating your character for The Guilt Trip?
Well, it was based on a true story. Dan Fogelman's mom.
He's the screenwriter.
He's the screenwriter, yeah. And she was a big fan of mine. And that's why she wanted, before she died, by the way, wanted me to play that part.
It was interesting that you should say that, because in a way, I feel like you're playing the part of one of your fans. And in a way, I almost feel like there's a little bit of Linda Richmond, the Mike Myers Saturday Night Live character who worshipped you in the part.
Well, I was trying to be, you know, a woman from New Jersey, and I thought it would be funny, actually. In the reading, I did it with a New Jersey accent, and then I thought, and you know, and I asked Dan and Ann, director and writer, what do they thought, and I sort of modulated that to be a little bit less New Jersey. But I was playing her.
So when you accept your son, played by Seth Rogen, when you accept his offer to go on a road trip with him, you call him Tatala, which is a Yiddish term of endearment that I think
that
is
wasn't
mostly
in the script.
I figured. And my other guess is that your mother called you Tatala.
I wish she did call me Tatala. No, I don't think so.
No?
It's just, you know, it's the way I feel about my son, I guess.
Did you call him Tatala?
Well, when that, you know, it comes out at moments of endearment and just they're like babies, you know. Some part of them always remains a baby to you.
Which is part of what the movie's about, because he objects to the part of you that sees him as a baby.
Yeah, but because we live on two different coasts in the movie, I don't see him that much. And she's living in the past. She's a woman who lives a kind of sheltered life and doesn't really want romance anymore and has been hurt earlier. And in a sense, it's like osmosis, you know, it affects him on a cellular memory. He also has a hard time finding a girlfriend, you know, and he's been hurt too. So I think it's kind of a transformative trip. You know, it's more than a road trip. It's a time to be set free, you know, and to get to know one another, really.
You know, in some of your movies, including The Guilt Trip, you have, you know, a very, like, New York or Brooklyn or New Jersey accent. How much of that did you actually grow up with?
Totally. I mean, I didn't leave Brooklyn, gosh, when I was 16 years old. I had never been to Manhattan till I was 14, when I went to the theater every Saturday and discovered New York City, which was like a different country than Brooklyn.
I know what you mean, because I grew up in Brooklyn, and Manhattan mm-hmm. was like, especially Greenwich Village, it was another world.
Yeah. It's a wonderful world.
But, you know, it's funny because most people have to try to lose their regional accent when they break into theater or movies, but early on you were giving roles where you had to zets up your accent.
Yeah. But see, I don't think I have that kind of accent now when
you
I'm
certainly
talking
don't
to
now.
In real life. So
no.
In a sense I had to, you know, go back there to play her, in a sense, you know?
In the new movie.
Yeah, in the new movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, your new movie is called The Guilt Trip. You have an album that came out recently called Release Me.
Mm-hmm.
This is an album of previously unreleased tracks.
Right.
There's a track I want to play that I think is just a really interesting document, as in addition to being a beautiful recording. And
what is it?
It's I Think It's Going to Rain Today with Randy Newman at the piano, recorded in 1970. What's the story behind this session?
I think that was Richard Perry was the producer, and he was sort of bringing me into the new century of contemporary music with Stony End and so forth. And he paired me with Randy Newman, and I liked that song. I remember coming up to my apartment and playing the piano, and we just did it sort of in, you know, I think one or two takes. And I like the simplicity of it. I like it a lot. So here it is, you know.
Yeah, so here it is. And this is from Barbra Streisand's latest album, which is called Release Me.
Broken windows and empty hallways, a pale dead moon in a sky streaked with gray. Human kindness is overflowing, and I think it's going to rain today. Scarecrows dressed in the latest styles, with frozen smiles to chase love away. Human kindness is overflowing, and I think it's going to rain.
That's Barbra Streisand, recorded in 1970 with the songwriter of that song, Randy Newman, at the piano. And that's on her latest album, Release Me, which is an album of previously unreleased recordings.
Mm-hmm.
Barbra Streisand, your mother sang. Did she want to be a professional singer?
She did, but she said she was very shy. So she couldn't quite understand how I had the courage to stand out there and sing. She would sing at bar mitzvahs. My mother had a beautiful voice. My mother took me to NOLA Studios because she wanted to record two songs, and so she had me record two songs when I was 13. And she was kind of a lyric soprano.
Did your mother sing a lot around the house when you were growing up?
She kind of did sometimes, yeah. My sister and I used to laugh, and I used to record her. I think when I was 18, I got a tape recorder and would record my mother. Some of it is on my Just for the Record collection,
which I happen to have right here.
And you hear my mother?
Yeah, that's what we're about to play.
Oh, good.
And this is honestly for any like serious Barbra Streisand fan. This has like so many interesting like demos and TV broadcasts, and it's
filled with interesting documents. Yeah, I said Just for the Record because it's most of these collections, these box sets, aren't they just recordings that we've heard before? But this was really Just for the Record. So my mother happened to sing Secondhand Rose in the same key as I did. I put them together, or me singing with Michelle Legrand and at a piano before I recorded What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life. I'm very proud of that box set.
Yo, it's wonderful. So what I want to play is your mother singing Secondhand Rose, recorded in 1965.
Oh, cute.
Yeah.
First, Mother.
Mother.
Then you again.
Mother, come sing a song for us,
no,
Mother.
Start that again now. I mean the tune.
No.
I forget.
Father has a business, strictly second hand. Everything from toothpicks to a baby grand. Stuff in our apartment came from Father's store. Even things I'm wearing, someone wore before. It's no wonder that I feel abused. I never have a thing that ain't been used.
I'm wearing
All the girls hand me their secondhand bows. Even my pajamas when I die.
That's Barbara Streisand cross-faded with the recording of Streisand's mother singing Secondhand Rose in 1955. That mix is on the Streisand box set, just for the record. So was your mother jealous of you or competitive with you when you started to have, you know, a career?
That's interesting you should ask that. I didn't realize it till one Christmas night when people were giving me presents. And she kind of went off a bit and started getting very emotional about, why aren't you giving me presents? I'm her mother. I'm the mother. That kind of thing. It was the first time I realized that she was actually jealous of me. And that was hard to take, I must say.
So I know your father died when you were 15 months old, mm-hmm. I believe of a cerebral hemorrhage. How did you learn about who he was to better learn about who you were?
Well, I read his theses. He had written two theses, whatever, however you say that word.
Like doctoral theses?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he got his PhD?
Yeah. He was a teacher, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he was very young when he died, 35. But the first one was on the behavior of my brother. It was written almost like a play, but it was based on the truth. And then his analysis afterwards, that was fascinating to read.
All about your brother?
Yeah, about my brother. I wasn't born yet.
Wow.
Now, I never read my father's second thesis till I was about 39 years old and wanting to see if I should direct Yentl. And with this experience that I had, I was able to read that second thesis, and it was all about how he taught English to prisoners and juvenile delinquents at Elmira Reformatory by using Chekhov and Shakespeare and Ibsen.
Hmm.
And so, you see, so much is in the genes, you know?
I guess that made you think about how there could be, which you already knew by then, like so much meaning in great works of literature or theater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So we heard a very early recording by your mother. I want to play a very early recording of you. This is something you did at age 13 in 1955.
Mm-hmm. That's the same day, yeah.
The same day, okay.
As my mother recorded her two songs, yeah.
So this is also from the Barbra Streisand box set from a few years back called Just for the Record. And let's hear it, and then we'll talk about it.
You'll never know just how much I miss you. You'll never know just how much I care. And if I tried, I still couldn't hide my love for you. You ought to know, for haven't I told you so don't know.
That's Barbara Streisand, recorded in 1955 when she was 13. And she and her mother went to a recording studio and just, you know, made a couple of tracks. And, of course, Barbara Streisand is in the new movie The Guilt Trip with Seth Rogen. It's so interesting to hear you, before you were really formed as a singer, before you're, you know, an adult. When I know it's you, I can recognize that it's you. If you just played it for me, I'm not sure. If you gave me a blindfold test, I'm not sure I'd recognize you. But so many of the characteristics that you're kind of famous for as an interpreter aren't quite there yet. What were you expecting to be when you were 13 and you were singing?
Well, I was known on the block, you know, when I was a child as the kid with no father and a good voice. That was my identity, you know. But
a negative and a positive.
Mm-hmm.
What were your aspirations then?
Probably to be just famous, I think.
It's funny because once you became famous, I think you receded from. I mean,
exactly.
You know, you don't make many movies, you don't give many concerts, you don't seem to really like the limelight that much anymore.
Mm-hmm. That was kind of shocking too. It's like, with stardom, you mean they shake your car as you get out, and Marty, who you spoke to, punched by a photographer, and the blood is coming down his face in the opening night of a movie. And I thought, this is fame? This is stardom? I don't want it, you know?
Well, yeah.
I like to stay home. I just like the work process. I like the creative experience. Mm-hmm. I like that, you know, that word that I felt at 13. Is it inspiration? What is it? You know, it's like, where did it come from? What part of the mind or the heart or wherever that comes from?
Barbara Streisand speaking with Terry Gross. Streisand starring in the new film, The Guilt Trip. You'll find a longer version of this interview on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Kevin Griffin. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.